But I thought we might spend just a minute here at the very beginning talking about, in all these various situations, what are some of the frustrations that you feel about work, and especially as that work relates to your relationship to God, or what you feel like God's calling you to do in the way of reaching out to others, or growing as a Christian, or growing in the image of Christ. Because that, I think, is what we need to focus on, is how that interface works. We're called to do so much as Christians, and then we're called to do so much at our work in various capacities, that sometimes it seems like it's just impossible to get all that blended together and keep all the bases covered. Noreen, did we get to introduce you?
No.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead so we won't have to wonder who you are. Need some help. That's right. Why don't you all share with me some of your frustrations that you have in your individual situations, and maybe even look over this and see if there's something on here that looks like you particularly want to cover, and we will try, do the best we can at maybe speaking to some of those needs, and if I don't know some answers, maybe some of the rest of us do. You know, basically, why did you decide to come to this workshop? What are some of the frustrations you're experiencing? Or was it just because none of the others looked looked all that necessary? I'm sure that's not the case. Anybody want to go first?
Well, I'm finding that working in church, we have four ministers and a membership of about 1,500. And I'm having a hard time dealing with, I feel like this is part of my ministry. And I feel like my training has been in secretarial work. And I'm enjoying it much too much for it to be considered a job.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to weigh the ministry portion with what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And we have too many interruptions with phone calls and people just wandering through the office on their days off. And if you have a new pastor, you may know my story.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had to kind of shield him from people just wanting to come in and get acquainted because he has such a way of drawing people to him,
mm-hmm.
and has been discipling some of the newer Christians, and he's begun these programs, and we've got so many things going on, and the fact that I'm not there every day,
mm-hmm.
has made some particular burdens.
Mm-hmm.
That the lady that I job share with, she and I have a wonderful relationship in that we can communicate day and night,
mm-hmm.
but we have been told that we have to separate our work life with our ministry, and that's very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be hard to do, especially in a church-related type thing. I mean, my word. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, because a lot of the goal of this workshop, and I'll go over my resources here in a minute, is almost kind of the opposite of for the layperson, to blend the ministry with the job, so that we don't have this dichotomy of I'm going to work and all my spiritual activity has to be at church on the weekend, or, you know, some other thing, that our job is our platform for ministry. That's the usual cliche that we hear. So I guess there really is a balance either way. I mean, obviously, if we have a job, the job is to get the work done and not to minister. I mean, we don't get our paychecks for ministering, so it needs to be done in a sensitive way, but still those responsibilities overlap. Any other frustrations or anything on here that looks particularly helpful along the lines of what you're going through in your own situation?
I don't know if it's frustration. It's just the balance of the whole thing. I think at this point in my life, you know, the career, the personal academic growth, family, church activities,
mm-hmm.
keeping it all in the proper perspective, mm-hmm. is incredibly difficult.
That's right. You know, we're called as Christian laymen to do so many things well. You know, your average guy out in the street, if he pays his taxes and doesn't beat his wife and kids and, you know, basically shows up to work on time and so on, then he's a model citizen. But for the Christian, the standards are so much higher that sometimes it's easy to feel the pressure of all those things. You know, I have to do these things, but do them well and with the right attitude. And, you know, my word, how on earth can we get all the bases covered? And so that is a real frustration, I think, for many of us. Any other ideas?
Well, I would just comment, I guess, on the
that engineering to serve three academic institutions. There's a lot of territoriality on the campus, and I'm in a position which is funded by all three, and I'm expected to serve all three. So that in itself has stress. Plus, right now, the campus has been in existence for, well, since about 1975, and there have been administrative difficulties because of three of them being in one place, and the legislature this year has decided they're going to fix it. So we're undergoing lots of, a couple of groups have come in and analyzed the situation, made recommendations, and now they're going to recommend to the Commission on Higher Education, to recommend to the legislature what they're going to do. In the meantime, there are lots of faculty members who are uptight. Do we have jobs? Don't we have jobs? Administrators and so forth. And I guess part of what I feel in the midst of this is, Lord, what's my purpose here?
That's a good question. Yeah, we all need to answer that for ourselves, don't we? I mean, it takes so much of our life, and you know, life is all we have to give. I mean, once we give that, it's gone. And like Gene said, you know, it's the end of the game. And unless we're laying our strokes for those things that count somehow in terms of purpose, then obviously our life can be very frustrating. The two books, this one at least we did have. I guess there's still some out there. On the Job Survival and Satisfaction by Jerry and Mary White. Excellent resource on the idea of work and fitting work in as a committed Christian, taking advantage of relationships at work. And then Your Work Matters to God. This is a newer one by Doug Sherman and William Hendricks. Doug is a graduate of the Air Force Academy, was in the Air Force for a while, went to seminary, and now, along with William Hendricks, has a ministry of helping people in work answer some of the difficulties they experience along the lines of ethical issues and relationships and so on, so that they can be more effective in actually applying the gospel to those relationships at work. And therein, I think, lies the big challenge for all of us. I mean, why put up with all these frustrations and put in so much time and effort if it's just for getting a paycheck? I mean, there may be other ways we can get a paycheck that would be less time-consuming, you know, free us up more for ministry in other areas. And yet God has led each of us to our individual situations for a purpose. Part of that purpose, I believe, is to have a positive impact on the people who are there for the gospel. But Doug Sherman in his books lists several situations that you may be able to identify with or at least find common. And let me go through these real quick just so we kind of start out on common ground. First of all, you may go to work unaided and unchallenged by the Word of God. And that's a real tragedy if what we do in our quiet time and at church and in our devotionals can't be applied directly to our work. Secondly, you may be unclear as to how to take advantage of the resources of Christianity for day-to-day work problems and decisions, the issues that we face day in and day out. Third, you may be bored by your work and see no lasting value in it. Indeed, you may feel that only through your religious life do you find any purpose and meaning. And that's sad because we spend 60 to 80% of our waking hours at work, and so it should be reinforcing and certainly not boring. Fourth, you may be skeptical as to the relevance of Christianity to the rigors of the secular work world. Fifth, you may struggle with the cost of integrity and need inspiration to keep your ethical edge, and certainly that's becoming more and more difficult as years go by. Sixth, you may embarrass the cause of Christ by living an inconsistent lifestyle at work, and that's a danger for all of us. Seven, you may not be challenged to influence co-workers for Christ. Eight, you may struggle with how to put work in its proper perspective and balance the many demands that compete for your time, like we've already mentioned. Nine, you may lack an integrated life purpose that spans both the public and private arenas, private meaning spiritual and public, that which you do otherwise. And number 10, you may lack a sense of dignity in your day-to-day work and thus your life. And I think we all can identify with some of those frustrations, at least a little or a lot, and it's important that we address those issues and get God's mind on those matters. Let me ask if you would agree with this statement. The church is becoming less and less relevant to the marketplace. Would you say that's generally true from the perspective of the people in the marketplace? I think so. We're seeing a divorce of the spiritual values, whereas previously in this century, that was had a very much a guiding influence on ethics and what was done at work. Nowadays, it has been discarded as irrelevant, and what works is what works, regardless of any higher moral authority. Would you also agree that there's a general downward trend in the moral and spiritual life of our country? I see most heads nodding. I think it would be difficult to argue otherwise. And I think the good question is, are those things related? And I think a good answer is probably so. But that's the challenge we all face, because most of us are in both worlds. We're members in good standing in local churches, and that group is very special to us. The church is very special to God. And yet also we're in the working world. And so we of all people ought to be able to bridge that gap and allow the church to change so that it can become more relevant to the work world, and allow the work world to change so that it doesn't continue to drift away from God and His principles. And if anybody's going to do that, it's going to be those of us who go to church and work. I mean, the pastors aren't generally going to be able to do a very good job. There's some people, pastor walks in the door, they go out the other door. There's no way they're going to relate on any real level, but they will relate to coworkers. Just a couple of examples of declining morality. This is called Boardroom Reports. This is a newsletter for CEOs and managers and so on about managing corporations, and put out by someone who's affiliated with Harvard University. But I was reading this article on the fact that manipulation is not all bad, and that was kind of a catchy title, I thought. And the opening paragraph, this is written by some PhD, I won't quote his name, but he says that manipulation is often viewed as being dishonest, and it can indeed be dishonest if there is inconsistency between what is said and what is really wanted. And then he goes on to say how manipulation can be used positively. And then in the second part of the article, he talks about out-manipulating the manipulators, not how to resist being manipulated if you don't want to be. And first, right here in bold print, under that is lying. That's the first method he recommends to out-manipulate manipulators. Just simply lie. You know, if they're trying to sell you a product and you don't want it, then just say you've already got it, even though you may not. If they're trying to get you to attend a meeting, just say you'll be there and then don't show up. That sort of thing. And you know, he talks about initially that manipulation is viewed as dishonest, like that's a bad deal. And over here he recommends lying as a way to out-manipulate manipulators. And that seems a little inconsistent to me. But I mean, here it is, Harvard University and, you know, the whole nine yards. And that's the type of thing we're seeing in the workplace now that we're adrift from God's principles. It's just kind of whatever works. And I think we could all bring to mind many examples of that. Y'all know who Brian Bosworth is? Does that ring any bells? Those of you who follow football, probably.
He rings bells.
Yeah, he rings bells. That's right. Very loud. Former University of Oklahoma football player, now the Seattle Seahawks, but he's written a book called The Boz, which is an autobiography. And in that, he tears down the University of Oklahoma football program and kind of an expose of all the rotten things that go on there, some of which are probably true, but the goal of the book, obviously, is to influence his reputation and standing, not caring at all for the reputation of those whom he accuses of all these dirty, rotten things. And just another example of self-serving, self-promotion. This guy was raised in a school system where probably the Ten Commandments were never taught, at least in any positive manner. He didn't have the moral influence even in the school system that many of us had. And this is the result. He's just out there adrift with no standards, so he does whatever is self-serving. And I'm sure we all know people like that, and sometimes, unfortunately, we are people like that, but hopefully not very often.
We don't read those kind of books in Colorado.
Oh, good. Well, I haven't read it either, but I heard about it on the news. Yeah, the sports reporters told me all about it. And yet, what are we commanded to do in society? And we should make a distinction between the world and society. The world is the cosmos, and that's kind of the world value system, and we're taught that that's bad, do not love the world, the things of the world. And yet society is simply the neutral structure that we find that God has imposed. And through society, God relates to man, and we can too. So society is not bad. It's neutral, and it's something that we need to interface with in order to communicate the gospel. But what functions as Christians are we to provide in society? Does anything come to mind? What are we to be to society as Christians? There's a hint on your handout. I think. Salt and light, that's right. And references real quick, Matthew 5, basically about verses 15 through 16, I guess, talks about light, and 13 and 14 talks about salt. And we've probably heard many sermons on all of these, but the teaching is true. The salt is a preservative. It's gives flavor. It causes thirst, hopefully, for the living water. And yet salt over-concentrated in one area is bitter and repulsive. And so we need to be some of those things to society. And then light, the application is obvious. We need to be the light of Christ and His gospel in an otherwise dark world. And these things are the darkness that we see, and we need to be light penetrating those things around us. And let's see, we'll zip through some of these scriptures real quick on the basis of work. The primary teaching, and the thing that I find very helpful, is the fact that God instituted work as something positive for man before the fall in the Garden of Eden. If we look in Genesis 2:15, we read there, "Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and to keep it." And this was before Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which is a little later on, Genesis 3:13 and 16 and following. So work was instituted for man's good. After the fall, and we might turn and look at that real quick in Genesis 3, verses 16 through 19. That's where God provides the curse in relation to the original sin of Adam and Eve. And if someone could read that for us real quick, Genesis 3, 16 through 19. Right. Mm-hmm.
"And to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth, and in pain you shall bring forth children. And yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And then to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife, and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you, and toil you shall eat of it. And all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles, it shall grow for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. But by the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return."
Okay. So what is it that God cursed there, specifically in verse 17? What was the curse directed toward? Right. And what specifically did he curse?
Mm-hmm.
The ground. That's right. He didn't curse the work, did he? Which is kind of what I always thought. You know, that's the reason I have to work so hard, is because it's a fallen world. But unfortunately, that's not true. The reason I work so hard is because it's good for me. That was a sad but true fact. But he cursed the ground, and it's kind of a subtle distinction. Obviously, work became more difficult, but not work itself was cursed. It's just the fact that it's going to be more difficult to provide the living and the sustenance and so on from the work that we do. Neither was having children cursed. Children are a gift of God, a blessing of the Lord. Having children was more difficult as a result of the fall. But still, we can't say that having children is a curse. I guess you ask some lady in labor, and she might think so for a few hours, but from a larger perspective, having children is not a curse, and neither is working a curse. It's simply more difficult, and there are aspects of that work that are cursed because of the fall, but certainly not the work itself. So that helped me a little bit in my attitude toward this thing that I do, you know, 40 to 50 or 60 hours a week. It's not simply because we're sinful and fallen generations, but because it actually is something that God instituted. A few more references in Psalms 8, verses 4 through 6, and Psalms 104. Man's work is placed alongside of God's work, and man is presented as a co-worker or a partner with God, just as he was in the Garden of Eden, to cultivate and keep that which God had created. In Deuteronomy 8:18, we find that it is God who actually enables people to work. And there it says, "But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to make wealth." Ecclesiastes 5:18-19, it indicates that God has empowered man to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor, for this is the gift of God, rejoicing in labor. And Ecclesiastes has quite a bit to say about that. So these are all indications that work, even after the fall, that work is a positive thing. Also, it's interesting to note that we're created in the image of God, and that God is a worker. In Genesis 1, God is found creating heavens and earth, and then Genesis 2:2, this activity is described as work, and that word is the same word that applies to man's work later in the scriptures. God continues to work. John 5:17, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, and he says that my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. So God's work is going forth. In several ways, he upholds creation, Colossians 1:16 and 17. He's meeting a broad range of needs necessary for the ongoing of creation, Psalms 104:10 through 30. And Deuteronomy 11:1 through 7, we see God working out his purposes in history. And then, of course, the greatest work, the work of atonement, John 4:34, and that continues until Christ's return. the work that God is doing in atonement. So we're created in God's image. He's a worker, and we should be a worker. Exodus 34:21, a positive command, you shall work 6 days, and on the seventh day you shall rest. It's interesting it says work 6 days and not five or four like some of us would like to do. And Proverbs 3:6-8 is a command from God to observe the ant and learn about diligence and hard work. Also, hard work is satisfying. Ecclesiastes 5:12 says, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. Ecclesiastes 3:22 says, I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his work, for that is his lot. So, again, not only just from that business in Genesis, but following that in the Old Testament, work is a positive, good, and satisfying thing. The New Testament basically repeats the teachings of the Old with maybe a little different emphasis. Does anybody know 2 Thessalonians 3:10? That's the no worky, no eaty principle. If anyone will not work, then neither let him eat. And I think that's a good principle. It says a lot about our welfare state. And notice it doesn't say not if anyone cannot work, but if anyone will not work. There are those who can't work and indeed need to be supported and helped. But if it's just a matter of the will, then we're probably heading the wrong direction. 1 Timothy 5:8, anybody know that reference? Talks about supporting our family. If anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own household, then he is worse than an infidel and has denied the faith. So we certainly should work to support our family. And this is often a rub for people in America. You know, how much is providing for the family? Is it food, clothing, and shelter, or is it a college education at the institution of their choice, a new car upon graduation, and, you know, paid up bank account when they get married, and a few things like that? And we'll hopefully have time to talk about a little bit more of those a little bit later. And then Colossians 3:22-24. If someone can look that up, and let's all look at that real quick. That has several things to say. Colossians 3:22-24.
Slaves, in all things obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who may be pleasing you, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve.
Okay, so what does that tell us about the idea of working in today's society? Do we have slaves and masters? Is that still around? That's right. And most employees think so, too. The application is employees and employers, and I think that's valid and holds true in that we do submit ourselves to an authority relationship when we choose to work for someone, and we're free to choose not to work for someone, but as long as we're agreeing to working for them, then we're submitting to a certain amount of authority. And then what's another teaching there about not only obeying, but what else does that passage talk about?
So not just doing it for an employee.
That's right. Working heartily or with a spirit of excellence, in that it is God to whom we need to be faithful and to please, and not just men. And that implies certain things about how we work, doesn't it? If we're doing it to please God, then God sees things that our employers might not necessarily even be aware of. And yet, in order to be faithful, we're going to work with a certain standard of excellence that's different than just your average non-Christian individual out there who's working to get a paycheck. So those are a few principles from scriptures, and yet, having read all those, I'm sure we don't feel a whole lot better about what we need to do at work in order to be more effective. We might spend a few minutes then covering the area of fulfillment. It seems like wherever you look in terms of publications, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or Psychology Today or Money Magazine or some of these other things, a lot of them talk about fulfillment. And it is true that in our society, the workplace has become the community to which most people look for values and help and direction, even more than they do their physical community where they live, and certainly not their church if they don't attend that. And so the workplace is where the value structure is really formed. And the value, it seems like, that's out there is fulfillment, kind of getting all you can and canning all you get, and a lot of that has to do with materialism. And yet it's interesting that God has never commanded us to be fulfilled. At least I'm not aware that he has. Anyone know any passages that God's commanded us to be fulfilled? And I looked rather carefully, and I think these guys agree. So it must be correct. He does recommend that we be content, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But fulfillment is something different, and certainly is not something that we find in our job. Anything close to that is probably to be more found in our relationship with God. Therefore, if we're looking to our work to be fulfilled, we're really kind of looking in the wrong place for the wrong thing. Part of that is because there is, due to the fall and the cursing of the ground, there's a certain futility in work that we probably all experience. I experience in my work as a physician because all of my patients are going to die. None of them are going to be immortal, at least in this life. And other situations, the architect designs buildings that are eventually torn down and replaced with something newer and more modern. My wife is a homemaker, and she does mountains of laundry and cleans the house and meets the kids' needs, and those are all things that are done over and over and over, and that's very frustrating to her because there's no end to her job. It just goes on and on and on. And I'm sure you all can relate to similar situations in your own work, and that's part of the reason. We live in a fallen world. Things break, things go wrong, there are frustrations. And rather than being totally put off by that, we need to realize that that's the world. And in the midst of that, we as Christians need to be demonstrating a different attitude, a different response to the sovereignty of God in the midst of those circumstances than the lost co-worker around us. And if we're successful in doing that, then I think we're going to be more successful in being salt and light to those around us. So fulfillment is an interesting thing to think about, and certainly shouldn't be totally something that we look for at work. Contentment, Jerry White talks about in his book, and he lists three main elements that are involved in being content, and we'll think we have time to go through those real quickly. The first is making a meaningful contribution, and to any extent that someone contributes to the ongoing of society, we've already discussed that that's a good thing to do. That's part of God's plan. Some situations, work situations, that's easier to identify than others. In the health professions, obviously, you feel like you're making some contribution by stamping out disease and sickness and all those noble endeavors. An engineer designing a product, that's helpful. A homemaker, the rewards are very great as you see these little ones grow up into mature adults. But what about the guy that, like, makes the little dice that hang down from the windshield in the car, or something like that? That would be a little more difficult, wouldn't it, to define a meaningful contribution. And even those things fit if you view it, that is furnishes a job, it furnishes income, and a kind of a group for people to interact. But if we're not making a meaningful contribution, it may be part of God's leading that we should be doing something else. And that's something I think we need to be open to. If we're not content, we need to ask why. And if this is the reason, maybe God's leading us to do something else. The second important part of contentment is relationships. And in most jobs, we can do a lot better if we just didn't have to relate to people. And some days more than others. And then he goes through five different aspects of relationships. And I'll just read these off. We don't have time to cover them very deeply. But personal competition is a block to relationship. If we're competing with a person next to us to do a better job or get a promotion, then that will affect our ability to relate. Ambition and ability is the second thing. Authority, if we don't have a proper response to authority of those over us or those under us at work, then that's going to affect relationships. D is serving. In Matthew 20, 25 through 27, Jesus was teaching about leadership when he said, that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and that their great men exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you, but whoever wishes to be great among you should be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first should be your slave. And so for the Christian, and this is where the rubber meets the road in work relationships, for the Christian the way up is down, and the way we are valued in God's sight is the extent to which we're able to serve others and meet their needs. And that often kind of goes against the grain of the world system, doesn't it? I mean, in the world system, the goal is to get to the top and have authority over all these other people and be in management and so on. And we can do that, do the same thing, and yet it needs to be with an attitude of serving that God will bless. So this issue of serving, how we handle that is certainly important in whether our relationships are going to be satisfactory. And then the fifth thing is the lack of communication. And it's fairly obvious that if we're blowing it in communication, the relationships are not going to be all that good. And then number three in this idea of contentment is the whole area of attitude. Philippians 2:5 says, "Have this attitude in you which also existed in Christ Jesus." And this was not an attitude of complaining and bitterness, but one of serving and self-sacrifice. And it's interesting, we had an example of this in our workplace recently. We have, oh, I don't know, it's not a large office, but we have several employees. And not by design, but just as the way it's worked out, most of them are Christians, the nurses and the receptionists and the bookkeepers and so on. And our office is in the process of moving from one location to the other. And as some of the employees were riding in the elevator at the doctor's tower, they were discussing the upcoming move and how much extra work that would involve and whether they were going to have to work overtime and whether they would be compensated adequately for the overtime. And there was another physician in the elevator with them, and to him it came across as grumbling and complaining, so much so that he searched me out and took me aside later and explained the situation and suggested maybe we'd want to do something about our employees airing our dirty laundry in a public elevator. So as a result of that, we had a meeting and we applied some of the scriptures to the situation. I think we're able to grow as a result, but certainly an instance in which our attitude can either positively or negatively affect those at work. To this physician, who to the best of my knowledge is a non-Christian, that probably didn't communicate to him much that this Christian office was any different than any other office. He probably thought, gee, that's just like my office, you know, so this Christianity stuff must not be all that practical. So we have a little more work to do there in letting our light shine before men. So that's kind of a painful example, but it sure is a good example of how that either works or doesn't work. Okay, next is the issue of ambition, and for most of us, that's kind of a dilemma, too, the idea of kind of getting ahead at work or doing an excellent job to get a promotion or to get a higher salary or to get more responsibility. too much of that can lead a person to be pretentious or presumptuous, and yet too little ambition can cause a person to be lazy or slothful. And this is kind of the dilemma. It's kind of a positive or negative, a two-edged sword type thing. And we often see this even in our own local churches and congregations. The person who has made it, so to speak, either financially or in terms of a work position or political position, they're often viewed as leaders in the church. And if the pastor calls on someone to pray, it's usually, you know, this person who's a prominent citizen in the community. And yet people who are trying to get there, who are trying to earn the money or get the position, are viewed as being overly ambitious and kind of self-serving, and they're kind of looked down on. And so I think we need to watch that we do have kind of a double standard about ambition in our churches. But Jerry White makes the point in his book that ambition really is neutral, and it depends on other things. It can be good, and it can be bad, just like any other human appetite. Hunger can become gluttony. Desire can become craving. Love can become lust. And so ambition can become selfishness and pride if it's not motivated properly. So as a result of that, he's come up with this list of both healthy and unhealthy signs of ambition on the second page of the handout. And I'll run through these real quickly, too, with perhaps some references, and you can look these up later. First sign of unhealthy ambition is serving your own ego. Jeremiah 45:5 says, "But you, are you seeking great things for yourself? Do not seek them." And I really like the Word of God, because generally it's so clear. It's kind of like, if you're sinning, stop sinning, and then you'll be happy, you know. And this is one of those examples. If you're seeking great things for yourself, then do not seek them. And ambition focused on self is not honoring to God. And we're all kind of familiar with the differences. And one person may enter the room with an attitude of, "Well, here I am," you know, and the other person may enter the room with an attitude of, "Oh, there you are." And it's just totally different. It's a matter of mindset and where one's attention is focused. Second aspect of unhealthy ambition is grasping for position and power. Again, reference for that is Matthew 20, 25 through 26. In John 2, 15 through 17, I've been quoted several times today about not loving the world, the lust of the flesh, and the boastful pride of life. A lot of that has to do with desire to control and have power or authority in certain situations. C, a desire to control others, Matthew 20:25 again. Next, a motive to be rich. if that's our sole focus, then that's unhealthy ambition. Proverbs 23, verses 4 and 5 says, do not wear yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration from it. When you set your eyes on it, it is gone, for wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward the heavens. And we really don't believe that in our culture, do we, that wealth is not to be trusted. We tend to trust in our bank account and in our insurance policies and the things that we own, the equity in the house. And yet I'm sure we're all familiar with examples of where it's here today and gone tomorrow. You know, the bigger they are, the bigger they fall. And a lot of times that's true. It's a very unstable thing in a capitalistic society. And our dependence needs to be on God rather than in what we own or what we have. E, personal competition. Philippians 2:3 says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. And the kind of competition we're talking about is not like in a football game, but the desire to promote ourselves at the expense of others. And that's something that the Word of God speaks against. And kind of as a summation of some of these frustrations or at least friction that we experience at work, is a piece here written by Richard Halverson about the double standards in the world. You're all familiar with who Richard Halverson is. That name rings some bells. He's a former chaplain of the United States Senate. And Jim Murphy, the pastor who's helping put on the conference today, apparently had some contact with Richard Halverson when he was in the Maryland, D.C. area. He's has been up there for many years. But he says that the way of the kingdom of God is antithetical or against the way of our contemporary culture. Our culture says, blessed are those who've got it together, who've made it, the achievers. Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit. Our culture says, blessed are those who couldn't care less, who are on top, who promote self. Jesus said, blessed are those who mourn. Our culture says, blessed are the mighty, the powerful, flaunted. Jesus said, blessed are the meek. Our culture says, blessed are those who are not restrained by moral and ethical taboos. Live it up. Jesus said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Our culture says, blessed are the manipulators, the oppressors, the influential. Jesus said, blessed are the merciful. And our culture says, blessed are the strong, the drivers, the makers and doers. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. Our culture says, blessed are the expedient, the compromisers, the conformists, the ones who don't rock the boat. And Jesus said, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And I think it's in these kind of issues, a lot of times we tend to trivialize these great teachings of Christ in order to get by with the needs of the moment. And to the extent that we don't do that, to the extent that we are salt and light, I think that's going to be the extent to which we can be effective in bridging this gap that we see occurring between the church and God and His church and the people out there in the secular world on the other hand. Healthy ambition, let me run through this list real quick. First of all, to be a witness. 1 Thessalonians 4:11-12, out of the living says, this should be your ambition, to live a quiet life, minding your own business and doing your own work, just as we told you before. As a result, people who are not Christians will come to trust and respect you. And that's part of what we desire to see in work, isn't it? That we are able to relate to people and they will trust us and believe that we do have some answers that they don't have. Secondly, to influence society. Genesis 18 is the story we're all familiar with, where God said He would spare the city of Sodom and Gomorrah if only 10 righteous people were found. And certainly one righteous person can affect the atmosphere in an office. If that's our desire and if that's our ambition, then certainly that can be a healthy thing in God's sight. Next, to be used of God. Elisha pled with Elijah in 2 Kings, please let a double portion of your spirit fall on me. So he was ambitious, but it's clear in the context of the passage that his desire deeply was to be used by God. And so to be used by God in that way is certainly a healthy ambition. And then to lead spiritually, 1 Timothy 3:1 says is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work that he desires to do. So ambition to lead spiritually is certainly good. And then the best use of your spiritual gift, Romans 12:6 is the reference on that. Okay. Promotion, real briefly, the idea is we need to consult God. It seems like the standard in the world today is we go as high as we can in our individual position. and we let the world decide where that is. You know, we go as far as we can and we stop and we're there, rather than consulting God each step of the way. And certainly, as Christians, we need to do that. Promotion may not be a good thing if it involves moving to another city away from a fellowship in which God is blessing and in which we're growing. And then the idea of lifestyle and income, and this is central in this idea of work and why we work and how much we work. And again, the question is, how much is enough? And we hear two opposing views on this idea of materialism, and one is the prosperity theology. Are y'all familiar with that? Kind of, if we just do the right thing and pray the right way and have enough faith that God's going to make us healthy and wealthy and wise. And yet that kind of rings hollow, doesn't it? Why do we not believe that? Why is that a wrong teaching? Any ideas? Other than the fact it doesn't sound quite right?
Well, I think to be comfortable, though, is to not
grow. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to be healthy, wealthy in life, and to be extremely comfortable and not in a place where you can grow.
Mm-hmm.
When you grow too comfortable, you keep depending on God.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And in my life, the times that God has allowed the most growth has usually been times of adversity or difficulty. And therefore, if I insulate myself from those things, then I'm generally not going to grow very much. And if the prosperity theology is true, that's to say that poor people don't have enough faith or enough whatever. And I think we're all aware of cases in which that's not true. And the worst part of that is the idea that we're in control. If we just do A, B, and C, then God has to bless us. And if that's true, then God's not God. And so I think we all see the fallacy of that. The other teaching, kind of on the other end of the spectrum, is the sell the farm syndrome, that we all need to sell everything we possess and give it to whatever charity is foremost in our mind, and then we'll all be poor and everyone will live happily ever after. And I think there's some obvious fallacy in that. But for most Christians, you know, neither one of those options are anything we're seriously considering. But the question is, as a citizen in the good old U.S. of A., which is a democratic, capitalistic, relatively prosperous society, what's enough in the terms of material things? And how hard do we work for what we get? When can we stop and do other things? Or when can we give away the excess? And the answers to those things are very individual. But let me cover a few principles that I found helpful along these lines. We just covered wrong thinking in case you couldn't recognize that. Principles, first of all, that God has given us the means to provide for our ends, which is work. And we shouldn't apologize for working. We shouldn't buy into the second story philosophy of work, where ministers and missionaries and those types are really the upper echelon of Christians, and all us lay folk are kind of the lower echelon. Gene used the illustration this morning. If God's calling us to be a missionary, let's not dribble down to being kings. The converse is true. Is if God is calling us to be an engineer or a homemaker or whatever, then let's not dribble down to being missionaries. It's the fact that God's individual will for our life is the number one thing we should do, and anything else is second best. So that's principle number one. The second thing is that a worker should benefit from his labor. The old muzzle the ox theory in Ecclesiastes 5:18-19 talks about reward and labor, and profit is not a dirty word. It's the price of staying in business. God is motivated by gain, and we're created in his image, and to some extent we are too. And we need to make a difference between self-interest, which can be legitimate if it's pursued in accordance with God's word, and selfishness, which is something altogether different. Third principle is we should develop an attitude of contentment rather than covetousness. Hebrews 13:5 says, "We are instructed, let your way of life be free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, I will never desert you or forsake you." And this is where we really kind of get into trouble, isn't it? The idea of being content with what we have. And one of the helpful principles that I think was in Doug Sherman's book, the second book, was an idea of a functional economy, which is simply that when considering a purchase, we buy the least expensive thing that will get the job done. And the question is, why would we buy anything more expensive? The answer is usually to impress or status or that type of thing. And we need to consider, what do we need to accomplish, and then buy the least expensive thing that will get that done. The example he used was a real estate salesman who sold real estate in a very wealthy area. And so his clients were people who had certain expectations not only about their real estate, but about who they would buy that real estate from. And so he couldn't drive his beat-up old Volkswagen to carry these people around looking at real estate and expect them to buy anything from him. So he was faced with the idea or the necessity of buying a car that would allow him to do his job. So rather than buy the most expensive, the Prestige, the Cadillac or the Mercedes or whatever's prestigious nowadays, he wound up buying a nice Oldsmobile, but something very middle of the road. It wouldn't offend his clients. He could afford it, didn't have to go head over heels in debt to buy it. And that's just kind of an example. Some people would say, well, he should, you know, get another job, and you know, that's between him and God. But I think in that situation, that's probably a good example for most of us of a functional economy. For many of us, it has to do with the type of house we live in. A friend of mine is a urologist in Oklahoma City. People, because he wanted to minister and have Bible studies in his home and have outreach through his church. So he didn't choose the ritzy neighborhood he could have, but he chose just kind of a standard middle class, nice, but simple home. And that's another good example, I think, of some of the decisions, real life decisions that we make based on our commitment and wanting to be used by God rather than on simply what we can afford or what will impress the neighbors or other co-workers. So when we talk about money, we're kind of getting down to where we live. But I think that's a lot of our interface with the world, and those are important things to think over. The fifth principle is we need to cultivate a habit of generosity and not greed. And this is difficult for me. I do have trouble being a cheerful giver, but God is helping me. And I can see the benefit in holding all those things with an open hand and allowing God to do with it what he wants. Okay, final part of the talk here, and again we have about 2 or 3 minutes to do this, is the idea of witness and ministry in the marketplace. And this is why we need to be different. This is why we need to have an ethical distinction. This is why we need to have different values than the non-Christian people that we work with. And the question is how to take advantage of that to influence people for Christ. And let me just recommend a couple of resources along that line. Jim Peterson's book, Evangelism as a Lifestyle, first, and Evangelism for Our Generation, second, are very good treatments of this idea of relating to people at work in a way in which they may be influenced to come to Christ. He talks about there are 2 ways of sharing the gospel. One is proclamation, cold turkey, where we go out and we share the 4 steps and they either respond or they don't, and we go on to the next person. And there's a place for that. The people who respond to that are people who are prepared due to church background or family background or something. The other folks are simply going to say, no, you're crazy, and walk away. And yet, I think nowadays those are the majority, and we need to figure out some way to be cooperating with God in drawing those people to himself. And he points out that this process, that evangelism is a process, not an event. And the way we do it is by getting to know them, by serving them, by helping meet their needs, by opening our own lives, showing that we have problems, that we have answers that they don't, and then befriending them to a point where they're willing to admit that we're different in a positive way and that they're willing to get into the Scriptures and study the Bible with us. At that point, it's not just our relationship that's influencing them. They're also opening themselves up to the Word of God and to the Spirit of God, and therefore can be more effective in drawing them to Christ. And we've found that to be true in some of our relationships at work. One of the folks that we have come and visit us is the drug salesman, the pharmaceutical representative, who come and sit down and try to influence us to prescribe one drug versus another. And just recently there's been a fellow who's been coming for a while, but he's noticed something different about our office and the way we operate and kind of began to respond and ask some questions. And so a partner and I have asked him to begin a John study at one of our homes, and he and his wife have done that and have been responding very well to the Gospel of John and asking open questions. And he's not a Christian yet, but by faith I think, you know, God's bringing him that direction. And then he's invited a co-worker of his who's a non-Christian and his wife, and they've started coming. And so we're seeing this process happening due to the way that we operate our office, which in some way communicated something different to him about values and structure. And you all can do that too, and whatever your work situation is, even a farmer and the associations of the farmers, homemakers of the homemakers, and any kind of contact with people can be utilized in that way. So we're about out of time. I hope that is somewhat helpful, at least in terms of perspective. I think in workshops, one of our main functions, though, is to recommend to use certain resources that if any of this is speaking to a need at all, do look further. And these books are a good place to look and can provide some of the answers to some of your questions a lot better than I think I can in just the course of an hour. Any other observations or questions? Your Work Matters to God by Doug Sherman and William Hendricks, and these are both by NAV Press, I believe. Should be available in any Bible bookstore, or if you know NAV Press's address, Colorado Springs, they'd be happy to send it. Anything else? I guess I'll let you go, and we'll go hear some.